history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be told. If we'll take a little time to ask some questions and listen, we're going to learn a lot. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that way, yeah, we are amazed. We are educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I know we're going to learn a lot today because we're with Mr. Julesberg. We're in Julesberg, Colorado, with a gentleman who's lived here his whole life, except for when Uncle Sam put him on a ship in the Pacific Ocean. Lee Kaiser, 92 years old. And I got to try to explain where we're sitting here, Lee, because this is the old Ford Garage Museum. How long have you operated this place?
Well, I never did have the Ford agency. Right. I got the hold of the building after they built the new Ford Garage on the west end of town. And I had this collection in different places. After I got hold of the building, I put this together probably 50 years ago.
Well, I know the word has gotten around, and that's how I found out about you. I had someone who had stopped through send me an email, say, hey, you got to go to Julesberg, Colorado, and find Lee Kaiser. And the first thing I had to do was look at a map and figure out where Julesberg, Colorado was. Bet that's not the first time you've heard that over the years.
No, it's quite often I heard that.
So when you hear someone say, where's Julesberg, Colorado, how do you explain it? What's your description of where you are on the map?
In the northeast corner of the state of Colorado, pushed up against Nebraska on the north and Nebraska on the east, and we're on the map. And also on the original Lincoln Highway. This is the first town that the Pony Express in Colorado was the only one. And then the Union Pacific Railroad came through in 1867.
And I know you know the history of this town. You've lived a lot of the history of this town. And when I say the old Ford Garage Museum, this isn't just cars. You have some beauties out there. There are Model A's and Model T's. There are touring cars. You even have a Buick out there. I don't know how that snuck through the door, but the historic antique gas pumps and the photos and memorabilia on the walls. You've got every newspaper going back to the 1930s or something?
Yes, I do, along with 745 Life magazines from World War II.
And is it true that one of those Life magazines even has your photo in it?
Yes, it does. Believe it or not, it's the famous photo of the sailor kissing the girl in Times Square. Yeah. But back farther in the magazine, Life magazine put on a show in Pearl Harbor. We came in with wounded Marines. Life magazine put this program on. It's called a luau. They took a lot of pictures, and they're in the back of that particular magazine, August 15th, 1945.
Well, you're going to show that to me before I leave, right?
Yes.
That way I'll put it online at hometownheroesradio.com and everybody can find it. Well, we're going to get to how you ended up in the Navy and what you did in the Navy and more about what you have here at this museum, which I hope everybody listening will find a way to get to if they're on that historic Lincoln Highway. There's a lot more to see here than just that big bust of Lincoln on the road to Laramie. I'll say that right now. You also have World War II memorabilia here, a whole part of the museum dedicated to that. But tell me about growing up in this small town along the railroad and the old Pony Express route. What was your childhood like here?
Well, my grandparents and parents were all railroaders. We came here in the early years with the railroad. My father was and grandfather was transferred up and down the railroad according to seniority. You could always bump somebody who had more seniority, and that's the reason why we lived in a few towns. But once we got here, my dad said he was in 10 different grade schools in his lifetime, and he wasn't going to move his family anymore, so we stayed here. And this is where I grew up at.
And I bet it's hard for you to imagine anything else. You're probably thankful your dad said, hey, I don't want him to go through what I went through.
We all got an education, not only in Julesberg, but all my children, for example. I've got 7 degrees from the University of Colorado.
But I'm sure you couldn't fathom all of that when you're growing up here in Julesberg. So take me back there. What kind of chores did you have to do as a kid?
Cleaning chicken houses, cleaning milk sheds, doing anything to make a few bucks. It actually was only pennies at that time.
Well, we're sitting right next to your historic barber chair. You cut hair here for 68 years. I'm sure you made a few bucks in that chair.
Yes, Yes, I did pretty well, but I also got into real estate. After a number of years, I had about 50% of the buildings on the main street of Julesburg. I kept them up myself. I did all my own work, electrical work, plumbing work, painting, everything. And as soon as I got a rent check, I took it in and put it on 8% savings.
You're giving us some life lessons here. Well, and I guess while we're on the topic of Julesburg, I want to hear about your childhood and whatever dreams and ambitions you had. But while we're talking about Julesburg, since you've been on the council here, since you've been the mayor, it's not just a figurative title. You actually have been the mayor of Julesburg. What is it about this place that you've come to love so much?
Well, it's one of the nicest little towns of anywhere around. We have a tremendous reputation of educating our children. Almost everybody has an education beyond high school, and we're proud of that fact. With very little crime, if ever. We had one chief of police here that no kid ever went to the reform school when he was a chief of police. He always took care of it here locally. His name was Gene Michelson, and he did a lot for the town of Julesburg.
I think I saw his picture on your wall right behind me over here. So as a child, oldest of four kids, you told me what some of the chores were. But what about your dreams, your ambitions? When you were around playing or something, you said, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do.
You have a lot of dreams as you grow up, and you don't always know what you want to do. I did not come from a family of means, so lots of times you just take whatever you got going for you at the time and try to expand on it, go forward.
Were you let me ask you about this. Since you are the historian of this place and you preserve so much history in Julesburg just in this museum, you were here during the Great Depression. Was the Depression felt in this town?
Oh, yes. Depression was bad for everybody. Nobody had any money. And especially the guys that are a little bit older than me, the older World War II guys, you couldn't have asked for any tougher men to fight a war than what those boys were. I often think about that if we hadn't been brought up during that Depression years, it would have taken us longer to win World War II, because they were seasoned veterans from the time they were just kids.
So it sounds like it was a tough life. Do you have some illustrations of things you remember during that time that you look back on now and say, yeah, that was real difficult?
Well, of course, we had the WPA, the NRA, different things, programs. And that was just to keep the young men occupied, and not necessarily that they were going to get in trouble or anything, but to keep the young guys doing something. The CCC camps and so forth.
Did you guys always have enough to eat?
Yes, but it's only because our parents were fluent in cooking and so forth. But lots of times we were short on food, but then our mothers were such good cooks that they could make a meal out of anything.
Well, I know you would have been pretty young, if I'm doing the math. When Pearl Harbor happened, you would have been, I guess, just a 16-year-old. But do you remember December 7th of 41?
Very clearly. We had a little ball game going on in a vacant lot right west of where our house was. All of a sudden, somebody come running out and says, we've been bombed, we've been bombed. And somebody said, well, where? And they said, well, Pearl Harbor. And of course, they said, well, where in the world is Pearl Harbor?
And I guess you probably found out pretty quickly. And did you see things changing right after that?
Immediately. The lady next door to us had a boy in the Navy. He graduated out of high school in 36 up here. Nothing to do during the Depression, so he joined the Navy. A month before Pearl Harbor, he was on the USS Arizona. A month before Pearl Harbor, he was transferred to the cruiser USS Houston. Well, we know what happened to the Arizona. He missed that. He went down in the South China Sea. A shore battery hit the ship, and three sailors was killed, and he was one of them. Then 1 month later, the cruiser Houston went down into around Guadalcanal, and they got in between two battleships, and they blew her all to pieces. And there was very few survivors on it. What few survivors were sent to build the bridge of River Kwai. And to finish the story, we were playing ball again 2 weeks later, and when the mother got the telegram from the depot that her son, Glenn Wise, was killed on the Houston.
So even in a small town in the corner of Colorado, the war brought death to this small town.
Yes, it did.
And at what point did you start to think, you know, if this keeps going, I may end up being a part of this at some point?
Well, of course, the feeling at that time, he said, this thing will be over in 6 weeks. He said, there's no way that Turkey can beat America. Well, we found out that wasn't true. It was a long, hard-fought war.
Yeah, and you're scheduled to graduate high school here in 1944. And I guess I should mention that. I understand for high school around here to field sports teams, you have to combine with the neighboring town. Is that right?
Not then, but we do now. We're combined with two other smaller towns.
Back then, those were your rivals?
No, we were different classifications. Six-man, and we played 11-man football.
Did you play any of those sports in high school?
Yes, I played all the sports. Football, basketball, and track. I was a sprinter. And I also was a swimmer in World War II for the Down Pilots. But the reason why, because we'd been in shape for track. Us 18, 19-year-old kids were the best in shape.
So, but you're 18, and starting your senior year of high school, you were probably thinking of other things besides putting a uniform on, huh? What did you think you were going to go to college, or did you figure you were going to get drafted?
There was no question where we were going to go. Everybody volunteered, as many as they could, but the reason why we didn't leave school is because we wanted to get our high school diploma. And this wonderful superintendent of schools that we had, Elizabeth Zorn, made sure that we had our diplomas by the time that we left.
So she cut a deal with the draft board?
She did. She cut a deal with the draft board, and they went along with it. As soon as we were 18, we were going to go. And she said, well, hold off until I get them graduated, which was only 5 months. And they said, all right, we'll hold off until you get them. But you haven't graduated by three guys left, kids left right after the New Year's, and then some of us left a couple months later.
And how many were in your graduating class here?
35.
So tell me how you ended up in the Navy.
Well, when you take your examination at the New Custom Building in Denver, they give you your examination, and then they line you up. I don't know how they did anywhere else, but in that particular day, as we walked through that line, they said, Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard, Army, Navy, Marines. And I just happened to land up in the Navy.
Boy, that's kind of crazy to think about, isn't it? That just that random pattern could determine someone's fate.
That's right. And all the kids in that area, they got the Marines, were all on Iwo Jima. But I was in the Navy, and I was at Iwo Jima too, but aboard ship.
So you're saying if you were one spot off in line, you would have been wearing a Marine Corps uniform and getting shot at on those beaches.
That's right. However, when we got left boot camp, we all caught three destroyers in Bremerton, the Hull, the Spence, and the Monaghan, and the Wilson. During the Leyte Gulf invasion, a month before that, Admiral Halsey was caught in the worst typhoon that ever hit the Pacific. We were supposed to be on the Hull, but the Hull and Spence and Monaghan all capsized during that typhoon. The reason why they did is because they pumped their ballast off to take on fuel, and we were next to take on fuel. But we still had our balance. We were still sitting low in the water.
Yeah, I've interviewed survivors from the Hull and the Monaghan who survived that typhoon. Oh. Yeah, miraculously. So,
well, they would be my boot camp buddies, because that boot camp, out of that 150 in that boot camp, there's only five guys got schooling. All the rest of us went right aboard ships.
So I understand. What was the point at which you would have gone on one of those ships, and why did you go to the Wilson instead?
Because the guy before me was a Marine, so he went to the Marines, and then I went to the Navy, and then so forth. It was just a matter of luck what ship we went on.
And what was your job aboard this destroyer, the Wilson?
I was a signalman, a striker. We didn't get school, so we'd pick out a group aboard ship that you thought that you'd like to be in. And I saw the signalman up there up on the bridge all the time, and looked like they were doing a really fantastic job of talking to everybody from other ships. And I thought, I asked if I could join their gang, and they did. They let me in.
Something tells me being out on the ocean is a lot different than taking a skinny dip in the North Platte River out here.
South Platte.
Oh, I'm on the wrong part of the Platte. South Platte River. But had you ever been on a ship before?
No. And Navy liked the Midwest kids, because they were easy to train. They didn't know what that ocean was like.
How did you take to it? Were there some moments that were kind of welcome to the Navy or welcome to life at sea moments for you?
I never did like the sea. The ship was rolled and tossed and up and down, and I was seasick a lot. Every time we'd go in the shore and stay a couple of days and get underway again, I'd become seasick again. But I survived it.
And to perform your duties as a signalman, what were the things that you had to know how to do and had to operate in those situations?
Well, it's like anybody that had scouting training, you learn the Morse code. I knew a little bit about the Morse code and was able to send signals before. And then, of course, that's what got me into the signal gang when I did have that background on the Boy Scouts.
So your signaling was all with lights, not with flags, semaphore, or anything?
Flags, lights, the lanyard signals. There was four lanyards, and you put different flags up there, and they all meant something. You had to read them with a long glass, 32-power long glass.
In this day and age, it's real easy to communicate. I mean, we've got these little computers in our pocket that can talk to Mars for all we know. But when you're out there at sea and you're the link between your ship and these other ships, was that a lot of responsibility for you?
Well, we were running radio silence. You couldn't use your radio, so everything was signal, flashing light.
Can you give me an example or two of the nature of some of the messages that you needed to communicate?
Oh, gee, that's been quite a few years ago. You'd address the fleet that you were in first, but you wouldn't name the ship, of course. Then everything was in code. We'd read the code, mark it down, then we'd take it to the radio shack, and they would decode it. Then we'd give it to the captain.
So if you mess up, one little mistake can make a big difference.
Yeah. Well, we'd always double-check it to make sure that sometimes there would be two readers on it, but you just didn't make a mistake.
And how did an 18-year-old kid from Julesburg handle all that responsibility?
I was a go-getter. All the guys above me, they'd already been on the ship for 3, 4, 5 years. Some of them even put it in commission in 1939. I was towards the end of the war. My responsibilities was very limited.
And you mentioned being off of Iwo Jima. You guys also were there at Okinawa. That's where your ship got kamikaze'd. But what was the first taste of the war for you, where you saw or experienced something that made it real?
Well, that's where the suicide plane started, was at Lady Gulf. Well, I'll back off a little. There were suicides in the Philippines, too. In the Philippines, on the invasion of Mindoro, the biggest explosion outside the atomic bombs that was dropped happened in the ocean off of Mindoro. An ammunition ship blew up.
And you saw it?
I saw it. We were 5 miles away from it, and it broke the eardrums on some of the guys that was exposed to the direct sound of it.
Well, I know you would soon find yourself in some situations where more than just your eardrums were in danger. I don't think anybody's going to be able to guess what led to your teeth being knocked out in a kamikaze attack. It's time for a break now, but don't forget to check out the photos and videos online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And if you're going anywhere near northeastern Colorado, I promise you, a trip to Lee Kaiser's Old Ford Garage and Museum will be worth the trip. We'll hear more of what makes that statement so true when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to visit with Lee Kaiser in Julesburg, Colorado. It's a town of a little less than 1,500 people up in the northeastern corner of the state that pokes a dent up into Nebraska. If you're ever taking a cross-country trip on Interstate 80, Lee's Old Ford Garage and Museum is just a quick detour that will be well worth your while. We'll talk a little more about that before we're done, but we left off with the 18-year-old having graduated high school here in Julesburg in abbreviated fashion, joining the Navy, and deploying as a signalman on the USS Wilson, a destroyer that eventually would be subjected to atomic bomb tests after World War II at Bikini Atoll. But a year before that, in 1945, the Wilson experienced some intense action in the Pacific. So explain it to us, Lee. When general quarters would sound on your destroyer, what would you have to do?
I was on the bridge as a lookout. Or if I wasn't doing that, I'd be copying the signals that the signalman was taking. Every signalman had to have a writer. I did a lot of that.
And maybe this is a dumb question, but did it occur to you at that point or any other point that your life was in danger, that you might not ever make it back here to Julesburg?
Constantly. My whole time in the Navy, long as the war was on, and we never got out of the combat zone. We were exposed all the time.
Well, and that was kind of the whole function of your ship, wasn't it? Yeah. To take the hits for the big ships.
We were the escorts and the scouts of the big ships, and we were supposed to shoot down and sink every submarine to make sure they didn't hit the big ships.
And you mentioned the advent of those suicide attacks and the kamikazes. What's the first memory you have of that, of either hearing about it or seeing it actually take place?
In the Philippines was where we first exposed to the suicide planes. I saw several ships get hit before the suicide plane dove into the hold of the ammunition ship. And then, of course, that was something you never will forget.
So when you see that, when you hear about that, when you realize that's part of the reality, I imagine there's part of you that says, hey, that could happen to our ship, and what's going to happen if it does?
Well, we were always prepared. We always had our life jackets on. We always had our helmets on for safety. But they didn't have to tell you to do it because you knew we were going to be in combat and something was going to happen. Of course, along with that, the destroyers were also assigned to ships that had been hit. And we went alongside a lot of ships that was burning and a lot of casualties lying on the decks of the ships. And then we didn't know what their cargo was, their manifest. Are you carrying aviation gasoline? So yes, we are. Or other war materials. And they would sometime be on fire, and several of them we couldn't save. But we could save what crew hadn't been killed.
That had to be hard to watch, hard to witness, hard to see guys just like you who are in that kind of condition.
That's very hard to see, very hard to watch. I still get calls from the East Coast from fathers who had been rescued by the Wilson. Their kids call me up once in a while and said, my dad thanks you again for saving his life. And that's just a small example of many, many stories.
Well, and you mentioned something that I don't want to let it get away without following up a little bit. When I was asking you about high school and all your athletic exploits, you mentioned the swimming while you're on the Wilson, that if you guys went to rescue a downed pilot, you were supposed to swim out and help him to the ship?
We put a belt around us with two hooks on it, with two lines. We swim out there and try to get the pilot out of the cockpit and so forth. It only had happened a couple of times because we took turns doing it. And if we could get them out and save them, get them aboard ship, we'd do best to save them.
So you actually personally were able to do that a couple times?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm imagining those pilots had to be pretty happy to see you.
Well, some of them were wounded. Some were shot down because they were, I wasn't on that detail. One of them couldn't get out. They couldn't unfasten his safety belts, and the plane was beginning to tip, and they lost him. He was that close to being saved.
Again, I don't know what it feels like, but it sounds probably nerve-wracking. You really are in a race against time when you're doing that.
Well, you can't say that you ever get used to it, but you get immune to it after a while. After you see so many casualties in war, lots of different things happen in war.
So it's one thing to get out to the plane with all that, and then you got to get the pilot out, and then you got to get him back to the ship. Was that difficult to get him back there with you?
Well, not necessarily. We'd get him aboard our whale boat. We'd get him back to their ship as soon as we possibly could. Or we'd keep him until we'd be in a safer area. Because you were always possible to be attacked any time.
Well, and that's what I was thinking when you're talking about escorting damaged ships and wondering what's inside of them. You're wondering because they're going really slow. They're a pretty easy target, a sitting duck. And by virtue of that, you guys are too. That had to be kind of scary.
Well, we had pretty good speed. We could do 38 knots, which is about 45 miles an hour. But we could also slow up real fast too, pull right up alongside and right quick. But we wouldn't stay too long in the water one spot for fear of submarines. Nothing would be easier for a submarine to hit a dead ship.
Did you have any scares with subs?
Oh, yeah. A lot of scares. We had great sound equipment, and we could detect subs for quite a ways. And I think we got credit for sinking three.
Dropping depth charges on them?
Yeah.
And anything that I don't touch on that you want to share, please do. But you mentioned Iwo Jima, and I'm thinking about what you said your duty station was as a lookout on the bridge. And I'm thinking about Iwo Jima. You guys, I'm sure, were firing some shells that way. But did you end up seeing the flag go up on Suribachi from where you were?
I saw the second flag that went up.
The one that everybody else has seen. A lot of people don't even know about the first one.
That's when I saw the second one. Because we were on the second day, we brought in the reserves for the landing. And the flag had already been raised. But I did see the second one.
Well, and what was that like? Because that image was so powerful here, back home, for people to see that Rosenthal photo of the Marines lifting it, even though that individual act had very little to do with the battle that unfolded there. There was such symbolic value in it for a lot of people here. What about for you, out there in the middle of the ocean, so far away from home, to see that Stars and Stripes on the high ground of Iwo Jima?
Well, of course, I was on the bridge and had a long glass, 32-power long glass, and it was easy for me to see it. But actually, our duty was to fire star shells all night long to light up Iwo Jima. So the Marines had a chance to see what was happening. And we stayed there for, probably almost 3 weeks. And then we had to restock our star shells.
You were the lighting department?
Yeah. Right, you might say.
So, and I don't want to, put words in your mouth, but was it significant to see that flag flying up there on Suribachi? Did it mean anything to you?
Not necessarily, because I knew it wasn't the first one. I just thought it was in the morning, and they were just raising the colors again. But come to find out that it was the reenactment of it.
And the most famous photo of all time, probably. Well, what else? I want to ask you about the day your ship was hit with the kamikaze, but I'm sure there are other things that happened throughout your time in the Pacific that stand out for you that were significant, whether it's a close call or something that you were proud of that you or your ship were able to do?
April 16th at 9:30 in the morning, we were sitting off of Okinawa a ways, waiting for, we called the cap, waiting for the suicide planes to come in. And then to the south of us, here come a low-flying plane, and our captain said he's heading for us. And as he approached, he said he's going to get us. And he did. He hit us. He was carrying a 500-pound bomb. He released the bomb before he got to the ship. The bomb went through the skin of the ship but did not explode. But the rest of the plane went over the fantail of the ship and scraped it with all the guys on the back of the ship.
And you're telling me what the captain's saying, and I want to make sure I understand. You're with him there on the bridge, and you're hearing him saying it, like from me to you?
Yes, real close.
And could you see it too?
Oh, yes, I saw it coming in. But I had the phones on, my helmet on, and their phones was connected to the cord. The whole ship was communicated with each other anytime. And so the captain said, "We got to get out of here." So I was the first one around the corner of the bridge. I come to the end of the cord, fell on my back, and the rest of the crew fell on, the captain fell on top of me and pushed in the speaker in my mouth and on my nose. I lost all my teeth of it. But they didn't fall out, and they said, "Anybody hurt?" And I was just a young 18-year-old kid, and I didn't report it. No, I'm all right. But later on, the Navy put in some teeth for me.
So how many teeth did it knock out?
All my bottom teeth and several of my upper teeth. Some of them didn't fall out until after I got home.
Did break your nose too?
Yeah.
And this was all trying to get out of there and try to help wherever help's needed. But what were you able to do after sustaining that injury?
Well, there's always a little bit of humor, whatever it happens. And I was laying on my back looking up, and the captain was on his stomach looking down right face to face. And he says, "Sailor, get to your post right now or I'll court-martial you." And I said, "Captain, just as soon as you get off the top of me, I will."
And it's good to have humor. You need it in those situations. But I'm sure it wasn't long till you realized some of your shipmates had been killed.
Right. We found that out later. Now, here's an event that was kind of sad. The men in the magazine were trapped. And the chief come up to the captain and says, "The magazine's smoking, Captain, and we don't know whether it's on fire, but if it's on fire and in the magazine, she's going to blow." And Captain says, "Well, what do you recommend, flood the magazine or take a chance he won't blow?" Chief said, "I'm not making that decision. You'll have to make it." So the captain said, "Then flood the magazine," meaning that if they weren't dead, that they drowned. And he said, "Now don't ever tell me how they died." He was a captain from the Great Lakes area out of Chicago, and he was a very good captain.
Can you imagine having that decision rest on your shoulders, having to make that life or death call about those sailors?
I thought about that my whole life and still do. But I imagine a lot of commanders in World War II had to make similar type of decisions.
And I think I read there were 5 men who died that day?
Right.
Were they all in the magazine?
Yeah, and that's where I was supposed to be, because everybody changes places ever so often to become efficient in case you do get hit. No matter where you are, you're supposed to be well trained for wherever you are. And those were all my shipmates and buddies that got killed.
And what do you mean you were supposed to be there? Your shift was about to change or what?
Well, no. Some of the guys are on the bridge and some of the guys on general quarters. We change back and forth so that we become sufficient in no matter where we are aboard ship that we can fill in. And it just so happened that I was on the bridge at that time.
And I know this is redundant for you or obvious, but for folks listening, I know they're reading between the lines, but let's spell it out really clearly. Your captain in that moment had to decide whether to definitely sacrifice those 5 lives or their lone chance of saving those lives was risking the rest of the ship, right? I mean, what would have happened if that magazine blew up?
The ship would have went down, especially with that 500-pound bomb and the magazine, probably in 30 seconds. She would have broke right into and sank. There probably would have been, if any, very few survivors out of the 300 guys aboard ship. Captain Roberts was the captain at that time, and he was a very, very good captain, very considerate to everybody.
And if you had been in that magazine, like you easily could have, you certainly would have wanted him to save your life, but the decision he made likely did save your life, right?
That's right. He saved mine because I wasn't in that magazine.
Well, and if he didn't flood it and it exploded, you would have been out of luck.
Yeah, that's right.
And you mentioned the 500-pound bomb that didn't explode. Where did that bomb end up?
In the communication compartment where all the signalmen and the radiomen were. A demolition squad came aboard from one of the big tenders and disarmed the bomb. Then they gradually pushed it out the same hole that it went through the skin of the ship, which was, the back end was underwater, and then shoved it out into the ocean. Then the crews come in and they welded the plate where the bomb went through. Then we pumped all the water out of the back end of the ship and went right back into action again.
Well, I asked you about the magazine, if it had exploded. What about that bomb? If that 500-pound bomb had gone off, what would have happened to you?
Well, being on the bridge, it would have buckled and I would have went down with the ship without a question.
If it had gone off, the old Ford garage and museum and its upstairs annex that tells stories more like what we're hearing today would have never come into existence. And I'll tell you, this is one episode where checking out the photos and videos online are going to add a lot more to what you're hearing from Lee Keyser. So I hope you'll go to hometownheroesradio.com or pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. When we come back, the specific duty Lee's ship had during the signing of the surrender in Tokyo Bay in September 1945. And the gruesome assignment he had to carry out right after that. We'll hear the rest of Navy veteran Lee Keyser's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Effler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler from the Hometown Heroes program, and I don't want you to miss out on a powerful exhibit that's traveling the country. Courage and Compassion, Our Shared Story of the Japanese-American World War II Experience, is in Kingsburg until February 4th at the Kingsburg Historical Park. Take your family, take your school group, take everyone you know, because this free exhibit will help you understand sacrifice, perseverance, community, and the value of freedom. For more information, call 559-410-0488.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Effler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Quite a story we've heard today from 92-year-old Lee Keyser of Julesburg, Colorado, the town he's lived in almost his entire life. If you visit his old Ford garage and museum, you'll find the beautifully preserved barber's chair that he used to cut hair here for nearly 70 years. He's been the mayor of the town, and he's preserved more history than you can imagine. Check out some of the photos and videos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to get a little feel on that. We heard about the kamikaze attack on his ship, the USS Wilson, during the Battle of Okinawa, and all of the twists of fate that helped preserve his life. But Lee, you guys had a pretty interesting assignment when all the bigwigs converged on the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay to officially bring World War II to a close.
At the end of the war, when the USS Missouri went into the surrender, we were in the area patrolling. Our order was to, during the ceremony for the surrender, that in case any Vogue Japanese pilot that didn't want to surrender, shoot them down immediately, but shoot anybody else down. Any other plane in the area, hit them so that they wouldn't fly into the Missouri. And that was our job. Then we were assigned, without ever going in Japan, I never did step foot in Japan, but our job was to go to Chichijima to disarm about 10,000 Japanese soldiers that was there. And so we did that and threw their guns into the ocean. And they gave us no problem whatsoever. But they found out that they had eaten the liver of the pilots that they shot down. One other destroyer and ourselves went in there with a detachment of 50 Marines apiece. And for the next 30 days, we combed the islands to find the bones of the deceased. And we found quite a few of them. But that was our job after the war.
What a morbid job. So what you're saying is the American pilots who had been shot down, the Japanese on that island, ate the American pilots.
Cut the livers out. And this is a true story, true book. And, of course, President Bush was shot down at the mouth of the entrance. Uh-huh. of Chichijima, but a submarine picked him up.
Yeah.
And he was saved, and he lost two crewmen in it.
So you're saying if he hadn't been picked up, his liver would have been eaten too?
Yeah. Wow. You might say that.
So you personally helped discover some of those remains?
Yes. There we are, fishing for the remains of the pilots.
Where did you eventually find them, and how did you find them?
They were scattered all different places. We combed it practically with here's the culprits here. And they were all executed for war crimes.
That had to absolutely turn your stomach.
Yeah, it did.
Were they able to identify the remains?
They did, in most cases. They didn't have the DNA like they do now, but these are all officers that did this. And there were some enlisted men that had buried them. So they showed us where some of them were buried, and other times we had to scratch the surface. And, of course, there was more islands. Ha Ha Jima was close to Chichijima, and there were some of them there, too. But everybody else, when this happened, all the officers who were older got discharged. And the family men with children got discharged. There was only us 18, 19, 20-year-old kids aboard that ship left on it. And when we finally got underway to go sink it at Eniwetok, our captain was only 26 years old, and he wasn't an officer.
So you were still assigned to the Wilson when it was decommissioned?
Yes, it was. It was decommissioned, it's well put.
Well, not too many guys get to say goodbye to their ship that way when it's supposed to happen that way. What was that process like for you?
Well, we kind of hate to see this thing that saved our lives go down. But believe it or not, it didn't go down. We had gone to Pearl Harbor, and we loaded it with sheep and goats and chickens and a couple of hogs, and had them board ship there where they taken it out and anchored it. And they wanted to see what the bomb would do. But the ship didn't sink. So finally they left it. They didn't want to get too close to it because of the radioactive.
And maybe some people aren't realizing that. This was a nuclear bomb test.
Yes.
Yeah.
So 30 days later, while they towed it in around Kwajalein, deep sea, they put a couple of torpedoes in it and sank it that way. By that time, we were on ships on our way home, so I didn't see any of that.
But when they did the nuclear test, you saw it?
No. We were laying too far away to see it. Then we closed back in a little ways to see the remaining of the... All the Japanese ships were sunk, or a big share of them. And then we had a couple of old battleships and damaged ships. There was probably 50 ships altogether.
Yeah, that's a lot of history that you've lived through, that you've witnessed, and you've been a part of. But I'm just thinking about your personal story. And from the point of, you know, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, you could have been a Marine on Iwo Jima to getting out of boot camp. You could have gone to one of those three destroyers that sank in the typhoon, but you went to the one of the four that didn't. To you could have been in that magazine that was flooded, those five lives sacrificed to save the rest of the ship, and all these close calls. How do you explain all that? Isn't it kind of hard to believe that all those things went your way?
Well, I think about that quite often, that every time as I got older, the things don't go quite my way, then I get to thinking, geez, Lee, you're one of the luckiest guys in the world.
Well, and I know you believe that. And I know how fortunate this town is to have you, and I can tell just by spending a little time here how revered you are in this place. And here you've built this huge museum. You've preserved so much history. Why do you do it? Why do you keep doing it at age 92? What is so important about this to you?
Well, first of all, I was a good student in history in high school. We had some books in our library, town library, that you had to read. You couldn't check out. You had to read them there. And I did that. And I just gradually got interested in Western history, the building the railroad and so forth. And I've always, history was my favorite class. That's the only subject I really got decent grades in. But I feel fortunate and glad that I did. Now, to answer your question, why I put this together was that I used to play golf with my buddies here in town. And we would meet every Sunday morning for golf. And one day I realized that I'm with these guys downtown all day long, and then on Sunday I'm with them again. So I'm going to do something else besides play golf. And I have two brothers that just are both retired military, and all they want to do is just play golf. And I decided that golf takes too much of your time if you want to do something else in life. And so I put this together.
Well, and I know Julesburg thanks you, and America thanks you, and I thank you for that. And I saw the barber chair. You said 68 years. Did you start cutting hair in the Navy?
No. I went to University of Denver for a year, and my folks still had three little kids at home. And even though I had the GI Bill, I let a friend of mine, he said, well, why don't you go to barber school and work your way for your last 3 years in school? Well, I did, but I never did go back into school.
Well, I think it worked out all right for you. Have you been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington yet?
Yes, I have. The honor flight.
Was that Northern Colorado honor flight?
Yes. Yeah, great ship. One of the best things I've ever done is for the people that honored us the way they did. Every place we went, we had a clapping ovation. So appreciative.
What did you think about at that World War II memorial, especially when you look at that wall of gold stars, 406,000 guys like you who didn't come home? What was going through your mind there?
I knew that the figures before, 400,000 dead, 600,000 wounded, but I didn't realize that that gold star would represent that many people. But that really makes you think how lucky you were that you weren't one of them. But you know, the other thing is, they got to remember that only 1 out of 12 of 16 million men saw action.
And I know you saw plenty. Did you think about those five guys from the magazine when you were at that memorial?
I got their name by my nightstand where I read at, and every once in a while I dig that out and I got them on a card, and I think about them. The chance that they didn't have and the chance that I had.
Did you know those guys personally?
Yeah, they were my friends.
And again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think what I heard and what you just said is that the way you've lived, the way you have, the reason that you've done so much for this city and for people and for educating future generations of Americans is partly to honor the life those guys never got to have.
Right. I think about them all the time. Then when I see young people, the way they act nowadays, it's hard for me to have any sympathy for them at all, because the boys in the Depression plus World War II was a great sacrifice. Can you see, once in a while I visualize this, a soldier or a Marine laying on the beach, they'd just been hit with a grenade or a shell, and he was holding his stomach in, probably about to lose it, and look up at the stars and said, God, what did I ever do to deserve this?
So much we take for granted. And I guess I've got to ask you, you just mentioned God. You told me you're one of the luckiest guys alive. You think it was luck? You think it was God? You think it was somewhere in between? How do you explain your survival? What's your real answer on that?
Well, the way I was brought up. I was brought up in the church and always had faith in my religion. However, I wasn't the best attendant for church, but I always think of a combination. My parents, hardworking, honest people, church I went to, and so forth.
And I guess God's not done with you yet.
No, I go to church all the time. I lost my wife 2 years ago. We always went to church. She was the organist, and my children did go to church. I don't know about now. I don't have any idea if they still go, but they're supposed to.
How'd you meet your wife?
She came here to teach school. We were married, and she taught here for 30 years and raised three children. And then she got Alzheimer's, and I had to put her in a nursing home, and I went up to see her every day for 3 years. And finally, she passed on.
And have you ever had to remind your kids that they would have never been born if you didn't survive all those close calls out there in the Pacific?
Well, I never did go into detail with them like you and I are. I would answer their questions, but I didn't elaborate on it. Probably like I'm doing now, which is probably, well, what's the word I'm looking for?
Are you saying that you've never really talked about this subject as much as you are today?
No. No, I really haven't, because nobody's asked me about it.
Is it hard for you to talk about it?
Well, it brings up a lot of memories. Sometime during a day or week or month, I can almost remember everything that ever happened to poor Chip. It's another word for it, flashback. It makes a real impression on your mind.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for having this difficult conversation with me today and helping us understand what you and those other guys went through. And I can tell how sincere your feelings are and how much you admire those guys who didn't come home and who fought alongside you. Is there something that you'd say you're most proud of?
Oh, I'm proud of my life, the way I've led my life. I was very sincere to my wife, sincere to my children. I'm proud of that. I've always, the other thing that's important in life is to watch who you grow up with and watch the company that you make. Mm-hmm. You got to run with the kids by the way you feel and so forth. You don't let other people misguide you.
Well, let me ask you a lighter question. I asked you what you're most proud of in life, but what are you most proud of in this collection? Because you've got some beautiful automobiles out here, and I've been to some great car museums. I've seen Jay Leno's whole collection. He's got a couple of my great-grandfather's Doble steam cars there. But this is beautiful. This is right up there. The condition that these Fords are in, all the other cars, the antique gas pumps you have, all the incredible historic photos of Julesburg all over the place. You even have some bicycles over there, a fire hydrant. I don't know what you don't have in this place. So what are you most proud of in this collection? Do you have one piece or one display that, for you, that's the creme de la creme?
Well, all of my pumps were in Julesburg at one time. Being the business that I was in, being a barber, these stand-up pumps would eventually go to electricity, and so these pumps would go to the farms and the ranches. Well, my customers all through the years, after all those years, they said, Lee, I got this old pump out there if you want to come out and get it. And so I rescued it.
And restored them.
And restored them.
And I know you have these horseless carriages out there, but did I even see an old horse and buggy carriage back there too?
Mm-hmm. That's local, 1895.
And how long are you going to keep doing this?
Well, as long as people are interested in it. Every day I get somebody from New York, Wisconsin, especially the Wisconsin Minnesotans are on our way to Arizona for the winter. But if it's okay with you, you asked me what I'm most proud of. I want to take you upstairs.
And he did take me upstairs. For a 92-year-old, he really flies up those aging stairs. We climbed up into what once was the Julesburg Opera House, where now you can hear John Philip Sousa's Stars and Stripes Forever providing the soundtrack as you explore World War II memorabilia, including the Navy uniform Lee wore during the war. He can still fit into that uniform at 92. I have some photos and video of his World War II museum, what he said he's most proud of, as well as his old Ford garage and museum. You can even watch one video where Lee goes through all his Life magazines, finds the one with his famous photo in it from 1945, and has some colorful comments about it. You'll also find a link to the book, Sorties into Hell, The Hidden War on Chichi Jima. That book details, among other things, that morbid duty Lee had to carry out to try to bring home the remains of American pilots who had been cannibalized by enemy leaders who would eventually hang for war crimes. There are many elements of Lee's story that I'm sure made a powerful impression on you today, and I came away feeling that this Navy veteran truly epitomizes what this program, Hometown Heroes, is all about. Even in a small town where everybody knows who he is, his friends and neighbors learned things about him today, some pretty incredible things they might never have heard before. And the way he's served his community and all those visitors who stopped through the museum, it's really a standard I think all of us can emulate. I never would have known about Lee or even found Julesburg on a map without a suggestion from a loyal listener named Jan. So thanks, Jan, and thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.